Chapter 6. Heredity or Environment. If intelligence has a powerful impact on the success or failure of an individual, it stands to reason that the intelligence of a nation's population as measured by IQ affects the quality of the nation. I came to believe that the intelligence level of a nation's people is more important than its natural resources. The remaining question in my mind was whether human intelligence could be significantly raised by education and training, or whether it is primarily an inherited ability. There has been a tug of war on the issue since man has built civilization. Even in the earliest civilizations, a rudimentary grasp of the power of heredity to shape human character prevailed among the learned. Once man had learned to domesticate and breed specific varieties of plants and animals for unique characteristics, it was a short step to realizing that laws of heredity also applied to people. Great thinkers throughout the ages have taken stands on the issue. In one of the oldest and most famous works of the West, the Greek classic, The Odyssey, the author writes, quote, "The blood of your parents was not lost in you, but ye are of the line of men that are sceptered kings, the fosterlings of Zeus. For no churl could beget sons like you." Unquote. French Jacobins and English empiricists such as Berkeley, Locke, and Hume succinctly stated the opposing environmentalist position using the term tabula rasa, meaning the mind is a blank tablet at birth, ready to be filled in by the world around it. The issue goes to the heart of who we are. Are character, attitudes, talents, and intelligence derived from the environment we grew up in, or from the genes that we inherit? More than 100 years ago, a pioneer of psychology, Sir Francis Galton, studied some families that produced generations of geniuses. Galton's research indicated that intelligence and achievement is primarily in the genes. Galton showed that a high or low intelligence runs in families. Since there was, at that time, no objective way of measuring mental ability, he based his assessments on what he defined as eminence, meaning illustrious achievements. Although members of the upper classes have disproportionate representation among the eminent, he found that among the upper classes themselves, although all their members were wealthy and attended the finest schools, intellectual achievement runs in certain families and their relatives the same way that mental retardation and even criminality runs in other families. In the next few decades after Galton's work, many other scientists embraced the idea of the hereditary nature of mental ability, and their findings dramatically affected social policy. One of the most controversial U.S. Supreme Court cases concerned the heart of the nature versus nurture debate. In the Buck versus Bell case, Chief Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes, Jr., in deciding to approve the sterilization of mental defectives, wrote probably one of the most controversial sentences in the history of the court. Quote, "Three generations of imbeciles is enough." Unquote. Holmes based his ruling on the belief that intelligence, or lack of it, is hereditary. In contrast to the hereditarians, Marxism incorporated environmental determinism as a central part of his thesis. First, perfect the environment, goes the argument, and a utopia, a worker's paradise, will arise. In 1948, the Soviet Union actually outlawed the science of genetics, all genetics, not just human genetics, and reverted to Lamarckism, a pre-Darwinian theory named after French naturalist Jean Lamarck. He maintained that characteristics acquired by habit or use or disuse can be inherited. Russian scientist T.D. Lysenko, who seriously argued that you could change the strain of winter wheat to spring wheat through short-term environmental control, became the czar of Soviet biological sciences and saw to the execution of those scientists whose research contradicted his crackpot beliefs. Both Lamarck and Lysenko are today rejected by geneticists. Interestingly enough, many modern American conservatives have also now embraced the environmental idea by blaming the modern social ill strictly on the liberal policies of the Great Society. It is similar to the way that liberals wholly blame the social ills of poverty and crime on the conservative policies of previous administrations. Some conservatives have gone from Horatio Alger's social Darwinist philosophy, which held expressed succinctly that the best, meaning the strongest and smartest, would rise to the top in a free system, to the underlying principle of communism, that all are equal and thus everyone will rise if the environment is propitious. As a young man, I'd readily adopted the environmentalist position espoused by America's mass media. Today is then anyone who reads the daily newspapers or the weekly and monthly magazines and who watches television will be deluged with environmentalist polemics. Childhood and early adult environments are blamed for a violent criminal's destructive behavior, a poor person's poverty, an F student's grades, a drug addict's or alcoholic's dependency, an unemployed person's poor work habits, a welfare queen's fifth illegitimate child, a sexual deviant's weird behavior, and a low IQ child's failure to make it in school. I had found it easy to believe the environmental argument because it offered so much hope. If only we could change the child's environment, we are told, we can solve the great ills of modern society. It seems so kind and humane to think that all people were really bright and morally good inside, only to be corrupted by an imperfect world. That sounded a lot nicer to me than to contemplate that some people were, to put it crudely, just biological slobs destined to be the inheritors of the failed societies of humanity. By accepting the environmentalist position, I felt I was being noble, understanding, and compassionate toward the less fortunate and downtrodden. It was the same kind of thinking that leads one ultimately to think of the criminal as the victim. Yet as I read more, I wrestled with the mounting evidence showing the greater impact of heredity. A guest lecturer in one of my school classes had defended the power of environment in shaping the character and the IQ level by relating the old environmentalist argument that a child locked in a closet from birth would emerge as a complete idiot. True, I had thought, but one of my classmates had the temerity to make the crack. But if you sent Coach, who was a particularly slow-witted athletics instructor, to Harvard University, he sure wouldn't come out a genius. My classmate's statement went to the heart of the intelligence question. Are we all born equal in intelligence, excepting perhaps those children who were born with Down syndrome or other debilitating diseases? Can we all really be what we want to be, whether a world-class sprinter or a nuclear physicist? Twin studies. One way that science has emphatically answered that question is through the study of identical twins raised apart. Identical twins have, of course, an identical set of genes, whereas fraternal twins have the same genetic relationship as any two siblings, sharing only about half their genes. If the environmental argument is correct, those identical genes, separated at birth and adopted by different families, should have IQ differences comparable to those in any two randomly adopted unrelated children. Furthermore, they should certainly differ far more in intelligence and behavior than those of fraternal twins reared together. There are many studies of twins, including a comprehensive study at the University of Minnesota by Dr. Thomas J. Bouchard, Jr., that received worldwide attention. The study showed that the IQs of identical twins raised apart were much closer than randomly adopted children, and that they were even closer than for fraternal twins who were raised in the same home, attended the same schools, and not a single twin study has ever contradicted these results. Now, let me emphasize this vital point. Identical twins growing up in completely different environments with different parents, different schools, different diets, different political and religious persuasions have IQs closer together than those of fraternal twins raised in the same family. If intelligence is primarily created by environmental factories, certainly the fraternal twins raised together in the same familiar social and educational environment should obviously have much closer IQs than twins who were raised apart. I looked up and read more studies demonstrating the power of heredity and intelligence and found that even those focusing on identical and fraternal twins raised together yielded additional strong evidence. Because fraternal identical twins are born only minutes apart and usually grow up in the same environment, they provide a way to measure the impact of heredity, while environmental factors are held fairly steady. Identical twins' IQs are much more strongly correlated than those of fraternal twins. Correlations generally run from about 0.85 for identical twins raised together as compared to 0.60 for fraternal twins. Psychologists Bouchard and McHugh reviewed over 100 studies comprising 40,000 kinship pairs, almost all of that type of cognitive study reported in the scientific literature. Their correlations of IQ were, in all the studies comparing identical and fraternal twins, it is found that separated identical twins raised apart scored closer in IQ than fraternal twins raised together. Other sources of excellent data are found in the studies of adopted children. Adopted children are closer to their genetic parents' IQ than to the IQ scores of their foster parents with whom they grew up with. Now let's listen to that again. If you're still not convinced about whether IQ is primarily heredity based or environmentally based, adopted children actually have an IQ closer to their genetic parents' IQ than to the IQ scores of their foster parents with whom they grow up with. Now that's pretty amazing. The scientific research on intelligence has silenced all but the most belligerent egalitarians. Unfortunately, the mass media in America are still promoting the unscientific and discredited environmentalist views of fringe neo-Marxist and far-left elements such as R.C. Lowenton, Stephen Rose, Stephen Jay Gould, and Leon Kamen. The media almost always fail to mention these men's political affiliations, such as Kamen's former position as New England editor of the USA Communist Party's weekly newspaper. Similarly ignored is Lowenton's pivotal role in the pro-Marxist Vietnam-era Science for the People, and Gould's smug recounting of learning his Marxism on his father's knee. Much of the public is still largely unaware of the overwhelming scientific evidence showing the prominent role of genetics in determining human intelligence, but the scientific community has become aware of it. Snyderman and Rothman did extensive surveys of those scientists involved in psychological research and found that by the middle of the 1980s, the vast majority believed that IQ was profoundly affected by heredity. Next section, the brain and intelligence. Learning that IQ is primarily inherited made me ask the question, what precisely is inherited? Sophomoric, as the answer seems. It is, of course, the genes that construct the architecture and chemistry of the brain, along with all its overt and subtle variances. To accept the zero heredity impact argument of the Marxist Lamarckians, one is required to believe that, unlike any other human organ, the brain is not a product of the genes. Scientists think about almost one-third of a human's genes are devoted to the brain, and those genes naturally vary. Intelligence is ultimately as physical as the structure that enables one to run with a football or shoot a basketball. It is rooted in the magnificent architecture and gray matter called the brain. It is hard to imagine our minds as physically rooted entities. After all, thoughts have no physicalness. We can't taste, touch, smell, see, or hear them except in the confines of our own minds. Yet our brains are just as physical as the muscles in our arms and legs. Their construction and wiring is crucial to everything from our intelligence to our personality. Even our thoughts come from physical processes, both chemical and electrical, in our brains. The context of our mental abilities is dictated entirely by the structure, form, dimensions, density, and chemical composition of the brain. It is the structure of the brain that's important. If it were not important, then we could teach any dog to read Dostoevsky or any orangutan to understand organic chemistry. The more primitive structure and limited size of their animal brains prevent them from having high intelligence. Because of the structure of some people's brains, not every human can be taught to read and write, much less understand the fundamentals of organic chemistry. There are dramatic differences between the brain of the human and that of the dog, or for that matter, the orangutan, that account for the differences in intellect between them. Even the dog and the orangutan have broad differences in their physical brains, and every zoologist would rate the orangutan as having more intelligence than the dog. In fact, dog trainers report that there are sharp differences in intelligence between the different dog breeds, as well as distinctions in the breed's temperaments and other aspects of personality. When I first faced this information about intelligence in dogs, I wondered what difference between the breeds could account for the mental differences. Only one explanation seemed feasible to me. Different genetic heritages result in physically different brains. Just because the human brain is larger and more complex than that of the dog or even the higher primates does not make it any less subject to the same laws of genetics. Each human brain is as unique as a fingerprint. Brains are, of course, vastly more complex and diverse than fingerprints. Neuroautonomist Paul Gleiss, in his classic textbook, The Human Brain, states that the brain is the signature of a genetically unique person. Most scientists agree that brains in higher primates and humans evolved larger over time because more voluminous and complex brains enabled problem-solving and learning skills. There is obviously a relation to the fact that a monkey has a large brain and is considered a more intelligent animal than a smaller-brained frog. Even Charles Darwin cited numerous studies in support of his contention that the belief that there exists in man some close relation between the size of the brain and the development of the intellectual faculties is supported by the comparison of the skulls of savage and civilized races, of ancient and modern people, and by the analogy of the whole vertebrate series. Now, that's a quote. What do the media gurus say about this? Years after I read my first article on brain size and intelligence, I read The Mismeasure of Man. Its author is an avowed Marxist, Stephen Jay Gould. He analyzed and tried to invalidate brain size mythology and research data from the 19th century, and therefore disputed the relationship between head size and intelligence. He ignored more recent and more scientific precise studies of human brains by researchers such as Todd, Vint, Simmons, Conley, Beals, and Ho. There have been many studies since Gould's book that show a strong correlation between brain size and intelligence, as well as show dramatic racial differences. And you'll read more about that and hear more about that in the Roots of Racial Difference chapter. With modern MRI, magnetic resonance imaging, capabilities, extremely accurate measurements of the brains of living human beings can now be made. In a groundbreaking experiment at the University of Texas, 40 students were divided into two groups. One with IQs above 130 and another with IQs below 103. Since that time, numerous studies have been done. A remarkably clear correlation of 0.35 was found between brain size and intelligence, a correlation actually higher than most traditional studies that compared head measurements and IQ. Currently, there have been 55 studies in which external head size measurements were correlated with IQ scores, or their proxy, on over 62,602 people, and the average correlation is 0.20. There have been 27 samples using brain imaging techniques on over 1,341 people, and the average correlation is 0.40. It became obvious to me that intelligence was primarily heredity-based simply because it was determined by the specific characteristics of the human brain. Next section is ego and IQ in this heredity chapter. The biggest obstacle in discussing the genetic nature of intelligence is our own egoism. Even though human beings universally blame outside forces for their failures, we consistently take credit for our successes. We don't want to think that we're limited on our horizons just because of the inherent limitations of our genes, and we certainly don't want to give too much credit to our genes, something over which we have no control, for our achievements. We don't want to acknowledge that somebody else is truly smarter than we are. We can readily accept an athlete's physical size and superiority, but we're very reluctant to acknowledge mental superiority. Sure, many people can acknowledge an intellectual rival's educational level or experience, but most people are not as inclined to accept that a competitor has a superior mental ability. Yet hundreds of serious research studies continue to add to the evidence of genetic differences in intellectual ability. Indeed, general intelligence is one of the most highly inheritable of all human traits. As I read the studies of IQ and understood its great impact on our lives, I realized why the IQ issue was so important among racial egalitarians. Most people, not just rural white racists, but the leading egalitarians themselves, readily equate human worth with high intelligence. If one brings up the argument that one race is more intelligent than the other, the egalitarian instantly equates that position to be saying that the black race is, quote, inferior. It is odd that liberals who dismiss IQ tests as meaningless somehow equate low IQ with blanket inferiority. How less assuming it is to see intelligence as part, albeit an important part, of the whole picture. IQ is only one of the characteristics that make up the human being. For a person can possess exceptional abilities and still not have an exceptional IQ. The way a person lives his life, his responsibility, industriousness, honesty, courage, morality, and a thousand other qualities is also vital in evaluating his real worth. To say that the black race is inferior to the white race because the average IQ is lower among blacks is much like saying that whites are inferior to blacks because the average black is faster in the 100-yard dash. Whatever their intelligence level, black people were genetically well suited for their historical environment in Africa. To say that their inherited capacity to adapt to that environment rather than the environment of computers and aerospace engineering makes them inferior human beings is totally a subjective subject. They would be inferior to what we value, perhaps, but not inferior to what they naturally value. At the same time I came to understand all this, I also realized that Western civilization runs on a high IQ. It is the high octane, genetically created fuel of our culture and our technology. I concluded that if there is a significant difference between black and white IQs, it will have a profound impact on our society. As I read more about IQ, I found out that the real political opposition to it erupted because of the racial implications. Now that I had a firm grasp of the relationship among intelligence, heredity, and environment, I began to plow deeply into the subject of racial equality with a thirst for the truth. As for myself, it has always been easy for me to accept my own mental inferiority in relation to many brilliant human beings. I have a respectably high IQ, but when I read about and consider the special genius of men like Thomas Edison, Francis Galton, Isaac Newton, and William Shockley, it is hard to be egotistical. Every human being is going to be inferior or superior at some endeavor. I am philosophical about it, for it doesn't diminish my own sense of self-worth to know that there are many men and women born smarter than I or physically stronger than I am. Nor does it boost my self-worth to know that there are innumerable cretins on this planet. I decided at an early age to simply seek the truth, not only because it was valuable for its own sake, but also because I believed that in the unvarnished truth, we can find solutions to the monumental problems facing this nation and the earth. All of this afforded me a useful starting point. Once I came to accept the power of the genes and the validity of IQ as an important measure of mental stature, I felt I was ready to take on the more emotionally charged question of whether or not there are significant differences in black and white intelligence and behavior. Thomas Jefferson's words inspired me as I delved into the most controversial subject in America. Quote, "There is not a truth existing which I fear or would wish unknown to the entire world." The next chapter is chapter 7, Race and Intelligence.